I arrived from Ottawa a few days ago. I'm very grateful for Ajahn Pasa inviting me. He looks out for me. I kind of look at him as the great uncle of the Sangha in North America. He rings me out and says, "How you doing? You need anything?" And it's very heartwarming because I'm living in a different situation than I'm used to. I'm living in my mother's condominium, and I'm used to forced monasteries. So this is the culture that I'm used to, this kind of culture. And so I'm very grateful for being invited, for the chance to participate in Venerable Ahingsapo's ordination tomorrow. And I know him from England. It's nice. And just to be with the Sangha again, and all you people out in the dark there. I wanted to speak about choices today. Choice is obviously a very important part of our life. How we make choices and the choices we do make will affect the kinds of lives we have. My mother broke her pelvis 2 years ago. It would be 2 years now. And it was a very easy choice for me to go back and care for her. She was in very, very bad shape. Her broken pelvis had been mismanaged. She had bed sores and all kinds of complications. She's 88 now. So I had the opportunity to kind of nurse her through that, living with her. I left Canada in 69. So this is the longest stretch I've lived in Canada since 69. It's a nice country. Good place. We've got a problem with Americans, but that's sort of inferiority kind of complex we have. But I just, in terms of choice, I was just kind of contemplating what a very easy thing it is to have someone that you love and that you're close to care for them. This is a very sort of, in a sense, it's a very easy practice. We use this word practice. I like the word sadhana, which comes from the Indian tradition. Sadhana for me always has this heartfelt quality of like vocation or spiritual endeavor, where whatever worldly situation is given to us, we work with it as a way of spiritual practice. The word sadhana, you know, I really like that word. And so I was contemplating what an easy sadhana it is, because it's very much obvious what to do. Just someone who's ill, someone you love and you care for them. And that opportunity to actually give oneself totally to something like that, oftentimes it's not so obvious, because we have other options, things we can do. But say in terms of caring for my mother, well, fortunately, personally, we don't have any issues, so there's nothing we need to work at. That's a relief. So we just sort of joke around and insult Mr. Bush and do things like that, and eat too many pickles together. And so on that kind of level, it's very, very easy. And then because she's 88 years old, it's very obvious that all the choices I should make are really for her comfort, not for my comfort. And that's very, makes the sadhana very easy too, because obviously I don't always like being there. I kind of oftentimes wish I was in a forest monastery with my usual culture and didn't have to watch CNN with her and these kinds of things. And do some cooking thinking, monks, we don't cook, so I'm hopeless. I've been a monk for 30 years, and before that it was pizzas and hamburgers, so I'm not a very good householder. And yet I now do a lot of household chores. But the choice is always very obvious. You know, the choice is to give up my own preferences for the sake of my mother's well-being. And that choice is heartfelt. And the rewards are very obvious. So I'll be, you know, maybe preparing breakfast, and mom will come in. And she's quite okay now, actually. She can get around pretty good. She's got a lot of problems that an 80, normal problems of an 88-year-old. But just, like, she'll come in the kitchen and she'll be quite jovial. And maybe I'll feel like, well, I really don't want to communicate. It's just what we have, that kind of normal feeling. Sometimes just, actually, I'd just rather not talk. And then the choice is obvious. No, you talk. Because that's the heartfelt thing to do. That's the sadhana is to talk. And it doesn't come from duty. It doesn't come from repression. It doesn't come from, it's just the right thing to do. You talk. And then, of course, that mood goes away, and I'm in touch with her again, rather than with my own particular emotional agenda at the moment. And I think an authentic sadhana, an authentic practice, the word practice can sound very kind of engineered, mechanical, can't it? But it's the word we use, it's a good word. But I think authentic sadhana does have this heartfelt quality about it, because to give something up, and the spiritual life is about giving up a lot, isn't it? To give up things just out of a sense of duty, or out of a sense of guilt, or out of a sense of that's what I should be doing, that kind of giving up without heart doesn't really work. It becomes either, like in monastic life, it can become rule keeping. It becomes maybe just doing it out of peer group pressure, out of idealism. I should be helping my mother, and so on. And an authentic spiritual practice or authentic sadhana has to be of the heart, I feel. Otherwise, the whole life of renunciation or self-surrender, whatever it is, becomes this sort of arid, joyless place. And we can be very, very well-intentioned in our duties and whatever things we have to do. We can be very well-intentioned, we can be very idealistic. But if it's not done with heart, then the choice we make is more kind of a cerebral choice. This is what I must do. This is what I should do. This is the way my mind should be, or this is the way I should behave. And those are our choices from thought and from idealism. And they don't, I don't think they really transform. They don't really transform the heart. If you consider our life as kind of like an apprenticeship or an artisan, someone that's learning how to do something, there is a necessity for repetition. And there's a necessity for doing the work again and again and again and again. And just as a good athlete or a good craftsperson develops a skill through repetition, so also we have to train the heart, train the mind through repetition. And if it's done with the heart, if it's done with a kind of authentic sense of letting go, authentic sense of compassion, then that those repeated choices with the heart open up the heart. So for me, say, if I'm I go through maybe periods of like restlessness. I'm not used to living in a convent, like especially November. November is a very difficult month in Ontario. Our winters are actually quite nice, even though it's like minus 20. I know it sounds appalling, but minus 20 is alright because there's lots of light. The snow, the days are getting longer. I have lots of warm clothing. I don't look much like a monk when I get out there. And my brother's ski jacket and things like that. And it's very bright. So February's quite nice. But November, I don't know, November here maybe is also, it's very dark and very grim. And then I'm in this condominium. And I get a bit restless, right? So I get restless. So these kinds of energies that come into us, whether it's restlessness or aversion or anxiety, we all face those. They're all part of our makeup. And an authentic sadhana is trying to cultivate the ability to make choices which truly transform the heart. Because we won't transform the heart in just one, you know, just like us, you just kind of change it overnight. That's not realistic. To transform the heart does take a lot of work. It does take a lot of training. It takes a lot of perseverance. So to do that work correctly, we have to make sure that we're making the right choices, don't we? And we have to make sure we know where we're coming from when we make those choices, because the choices we make have consequences, law of karma. And those consequences accumulate. And so that our life becomes, the result of our choices is accumulated consequences. That's what the vipaka is about. And if we're not aware of why we do things and how we do them, then of course the training of the heart won't really work if we don't have that awareness. If we have that awareness and we see that the consequences of our choices are more sadness or more self-disparagement or more unhappiness or more alienation, we'll say, okay, there's something about the choices I'm making which are giving these results. How am I making my choices? But if we're not awake to the way we choose to think, the way we choose to think about ourselves, the way we choose to think through moods, then if we're not aware of that, then there's no freedom. There's no escape. There's no liberation. And in Buddhist theory, we're always making choices. The mind's always making choices, even if we're not awake to them. Let's say if I'm in a negative mood and I'm in the flat and I'm thinking, oh God, another grey day, November, Ottawa, God, blah blah, sort of the whinging mind, I might not be aware of that. It might just be sort of on a automatic pilot. Yeah? But the mind is still making choices, and that tendency of abiding in a negative mind state is reinforced. So there is still a price to pay. In the law of karma, doesn't sort of go away because I'm not aware. It's still operative. If I'm not careful and I trip on the sidewalk, the law of gravity still works. The law of gravity doesn't say, "Well, he's not careful. We'll take care of him now." It still works. And so even if we're not aware of the choices we're making, we're still going to have accumulated results, aren't we? It's just the nature of it. So the consequences are there, and we face those. And that's quite often when we come into the spiritual life, we are working with consequences of thought, of emotion, of habit, of social upbringing and all of that, that we weren't really aware of. And so we have these uprisings, upwellings of maybe negativity, but we also have uprisings and tendencies and habits which are very wholesome and very skillful. Quite often, if we're not aware of choices, we just go to a sort of default mechanism. Our minds just click into maybe a default mechanism. And unfortunately, for the untrained mind, the default mechanisms are all tend to be, you know, they can be very negative. Very negative. Self-criticism or dullness or depression or anxiety. So the training of the heart is a continual need to kind of really uplift the mind. To kind of lift your energy from the gravity of of default mechanisms. Because it is like gravity, can really pull you into it, anxiety or whatever it is. And so most practitioners, I think, in the sadhanas that they are involved with, develop develop very simple ways of turning to something skillful. It takes the initial development of practice is just figuring out how it works. How does the mind work? And how does your emotional conditioning arise? And how do you think through that emotional conditioning? And what are the ways that you could move to make the heart happy and open? And what are the ways that you operate that makes the heart depressed or sad or negative or angry or fearful? And that initial phase of trying to figure it all out is also combined with study. And we have a teaching, and the reason we have a teaching is not just so that we are Orthodox Buddhists, but so that we can practice. So you have orthodoxy, which is the right understanding, but also you have orthopraxy, you have the practice, the doing. And study or some grasp of how it all works is terribly important. What I teach in Ottawa, and sometimes I teach with people who are more familiar with Buddhist tradition, and sometimes I teach people who are just kind of inner city people. I teach at the Quaker Center, and I notice some people there, they have a real hodgepodge of ideas of spirituality, good folk, and they've never really thought through the teaching. They've taken a smattering of this and smattering of that, and they've not really logically thought through why the teaching is the way it is. Why does the Buddha present the five khandhas or the Four Noble Truths or Anicca Dukkha Anatta, these different teachings? Why is that? How does that fit? How does that all work? And because they don't have that kind of intellectual paradigm in their minds, it's not clear. They can often swing between Sufism and psychotherapy and Theravada Buddhism and Mahayana Buddhism and be very much caught up in doubt. Not that any of those are right or wrong, but they often don't have a nice model to work with. And that's where study comes in. And this is what we go through as monastics. We try to grasp the basic structure of this teaching. And then, of course, we have to internalize that. And we have to make Four Noble Truths relevant to my sense of being depressed, or the Four Noble Truths relevant to my being excited about something, or whatever it is. So there's that whole phase in the spiritual life, in a Buddhist practice, requires a certain amount of attention and effort, and actually choose to study, not just to get inspired, but actually choose to go through the difficulty of getting this down in thought, and then the application to your own inner system and to your own inner conditioning. But once that work is done, and one gets a good feeling for what the teaching is and who you are within that, and what your conditioning is within that, you get a feeling for the doing of the practice, and it becomes much more intuitive. It doesn't require so much analysis. It doesn't require that much thought, really. You just understand these kinds of moods, these kinds of conditions. All of it requires the ability to awaken. That's the entry point. Without actually opening and awakening to the way things are, there can be no practice, right, obviously. So then within that kind of study framework, inquiry framework, it becomes... One, I think most people begin to have some personal, creative, personal, intuitive way of making choices to liberate the heart. And it is a kind of creative, there is a creative sensitivity there because we are all different, right? So like my particular accumulated consequences this lifetime. I've suffered a tremendous amount of anxiety. I don't know why. But I'm a kind of expert on anxiety. You know, it's all kinds of flavors of it and parameters and volumes, and I know it in the body and all that. And that's what I've had to learn about in this particular. I've learned other things, obviously. I can sew. But this seems more important. This is the territory I have to understand, right? And so there's the teaching, which is very abstract. And Machin Cha didn't seem very afraid. He kind of gave me some instruction, but it was really up to me to merge those two. But then in the beginning, there's just the difficulty of like trying to get rid of fear and then trying to analyze it and what's wrong with me, and then just beginning just to know it, and this is anxiety, fear, and this is in the body. And then once you kind of understand some of those difficulties that you face as a human being, and they're usually not that many, the storylines and the narratives around anger or around fear and depression are myriad, aren't they? I can be anxious about 101 things or a million things, but just the very energy of anxiety or the energy of depression, they're actually probably not that many. And once one begins to deconstruct all of that from all the thoughts and the narratives and all the self-views around it, well, this is just one particular kind of energy. This is one particular kind of manifestation. You creatively and intuitively learn how to be with that, to shift that, to pay attention in other ways, and your choice becomes much more moment by moment, much more on the mark, intuitive, as I was saying. You just get good at it, basically, and the practice begins to roll. And when you read, like, say, for like, if you read about Ajahn Sumedho, that he uses this sound of silence a lot. If you read his work, he's always talking about the sound of silence, and that's something that he's developed as a way of opening his mind. Others will talk about, like for me, so like anxiety is something that I know in my guts, and in my guts very well, and I use the heart chakra a lot. So I've got a very simple method now, over a few years of practice, where when the mood goes into thought, I can just bring my attention to another place. So the mood wants to go into thought, it might be a depressed mood, anxious mood, or just thought in general, just back down in one place, back down in one place, back down in one place, back down in one place. Very simple, very constant, very persevering kind of training of the heart. That it has to, this kind of things aren't, they can't be just a technique you do because you've heard about it or it sounds neat or whatever. They have to come from an authentic understanding of really who you are or who you're not. and how you get motivated by life and how the motivations and the choices that you make are skillful or unskillful. And this takes a lot of a lot of honesty, doesn't it? You have to be very, very honest to yourself and very, very sincere about Dhamma. And yet it's not a question of self-hatred or self-criticism or self-disparagement, because that's really not spirituality, that's just idealism and egotism. We all face certain patterns which are difficult, and so the idea of sadhana is that those very difficulties and those containments that we get in life, be it sickness, be it caring for my mother or maybe being with a difficult adolescent that's growing up or whatever, that those are not really so much hassles that, you know, when you get around this hassle you're going to be happy, but rather they are the very place where sadhana takes place. So the very, like if I'm in the kitchen and I'm feeling grumpy and I don't want to talk to my mom, I can feel very threatened by that. Oh God, you know, I hope she doesn't see my mood, because I don't want to hurt the dear old girl. But if you see it as just something that's wrong with you, or that's something you have to get rid of, or it's a, you know, that kind of attitude isn't sadhana. Sadhana is always, okay, this is an unskillful state of mind. Say, what do I need to do now is to shift the attention. Where can I go, and how can I go, and how can I do this? And this kind of attitude then means that the authentic spiritual practice takes place where it can only take place, because the only place you notice your anxieties is where you feel anxious. The only place you notice depression is when things depress you, or make you confused, or make you angry. So if you see that as a sadhana, then the very uprising of a negative state of mind is also the place and time where you develop the skill to go to the heart, go to the sound of silence, feel it in your guts, feel it in your body. And this is where the transformation of heart can take place. And it is a kind of transformative thing. It's not a thinking thing. Oftentimes people will experience some negative state of mind or whatever, and you'll notice the default mechanism for most of us when we have some negativity is in thought, isn't it? If I feel critical of you for some reason, I think you're not up to the mark. What happens? Rather than me knowing that as the dharma of annoyance, say, to really know that as a mood of the mind, the default mechanism for most of us is to think, say in this case, negative thoughts. Why are you this way? You shouldn't be that way. You shouldn't be doing this. And that default mechanism then goes on, and then we start thinking, well, why am I thinking like that? And I shouldn't be thinking like that. My practice isn't good. Why is my practice? And actually, we never really transform the heart, because we stay in thought. We stay in some kind of analytical, critical, judgmental mode. And authentic Dhamma practice is to really see this is, it's not the scenario, it's the heart. It's the mood of the mind. And this mood is skillful or unskillful. And if these thoughts, if I pursue these thoughts, that they're not going to take me anywhere. And then the movement isn't in thought, the movement more is in mood. You shift your attention to something skillful, not out of repression, but just because it's a skillful thing to do. Or you feel the mood in your body. You experience it as an energetic form in the body. And then when that energy is experienced fully, then of course it transforms. It doesn't get stuck in thought. Thought's a kind of constipation of energy, isn't it? If you think about, like, if you worry, and then you worry, and then you worry, don't you? And that's just like an endless kind of inward cycle. It doesn't eliminate. So what is the transformation of worry? And the transformation of worry is in the body. It's not in thought. Because worry has both a mental component and has an energetic component. And if you're looking at this as a sadhana, well, you have to really understand worry or depression. And how can you understand it? Well, you can't understand it if you think about it. If I think about worry, then I'm not really understanding it. Just as if I think about the deer that were here, that are here, that kind of thing. And I just think about deer, I don't ever see the deer. But when I stop and I observe and I feel and I receive that whole experience of dearness, then I'm beginning to really understand dear. Not through some kind of thought, but through a very direct contact. And the same with our hearts and our bodies, the moods that we experience, we have to touch them in a very authentic way, not just through thought. And then when we touch them and we feel them, then the energy does get transformed. So like if you experience depression is very hard. When the mind starts to get depressed, when it gets down, the thoughts will be depressing thoughts, won't they? What else are you going to think about? You're not going to think inspiring thoughts. And then if there is no awakeness or awareness, no samadhi, whatever it is, then maybe get more thoughts and it's a downward spiral. But if there's inquiry, if there's awakeness, and there's a kind of like really knowing, oh, this is what a down, like if I'm feeling down in November, in Ottawa, what does this really feel like? That kind of inquiry. Then the choice I make, I can make choices, but the choice I make comes from inquiry, from understanding, rather than just from thought. The body, the heart chakra, the body, your guts, all of that are a very rich source of information. There's a tremendous amount of information in the energetic body, in the physical body, in the muscular body. All these moods register there. And if we simply dwell in the thought forms, the narratives, the storylines and all of that, we're actually experiencing these things in a very shallow level. It's just like if I just think about the color of the deer, it's a grey-brown. As soon as I say it's a grey-brown, well, that's not it. That's just an abstraction. But when I allow visual perception to take place and I receive the colors, then I experience that color in a totally different way. And in the same way, the negativities of the heart have to be experienced in that way. They have to be felt. And that's very difficult to do because we don't want them there. We'd rather not feel fear. We'd rather not feel these things. The nature of the word, the language we often use, like letting go, or non-attachment, or that kind of language, is kind of difficult language because it often feels like you're trying to get rid of something. So let go. You're too attached. Sometimes in Buddhist circles, you get the kind of Buddhist put down. So you're feeling upset about someone. Let's say someone insults you and calls you some awful thing at work, and then you feel you really take it personally, and you really feel hurt by that. Well, the Buddhist put down would say, "Don't take it personally." Yeah, I know, but I am taking it personally. Or you're too sensitive. Well, thanks. That's helpful. I'll work on that. And it's true that maybe, you know, I am too sensitive or I am taking it personally, but it does hurt. And so you have to be careful of Buddhist language is not to get caught up in dismissiveness of others or self-dismissiveness. So like an authentic practice is not saying that you shouldn't feel sensitive or shouldn't take it personally. An authentic practice is, oh, this is what it feels like to be hurt. From there you can move. And that's not an ideal of Buddhist equanimity. Equanimity, peacefulness, comes about through distress, doesn't it? How do I reach that place of equanimity they all talk about? You kind of read these things about this equanimous monk, and the tiger growls at him and he chants the metta practice. Yeah, great. And then someone insults me, I feel totally wiped out by it. You know, I feel very guilty about that. They can handle the lions, I can't handle an insult. But you have to be very, very honest to what you do feel. And idealism is not reality. It's good to have an ideal. It's good to have goals about what we're working towards, the equanimous heart. But how does equanimity really, peacefulness really come about? Well, it comes about through like feeling something like anxiety, and then being willing to fully know that, and fully embrace that feeling, not take it to thought, fully registered in the body until it goes through us. And through that kind of process, equanimity comes about because the heart is liberated from the tendencies towards, say, anxiety or whatever. Equanimity. And then it's a natural peacefulness where the mind doesn't get triggered by things. But that can only come about by acceptance of the way things are, not through some dismissive idealism of how, you know, the texts say you should be. So there's this kind of integrity and responsibility we have to practice, but also one of deep compassion for suffering. Not a self-indulgent kind of thing, but think, no, this really does hurt. No matter how trivial it might seem. You know, one person might get blown away by a trivial comment, and another person might not even be affected by it, but that's neither here nor there, is there? It is as it is. I shouldn't feel this way, I shouldn't be so upset, but I am. This is what it does feel like. So self-honesty and a real compassion for suffering means that we can embrace these things, and then as they process through the body, as they are felt in the breathing system, the whole breathing system begins to relax. You find that you're like the end of your out-breath begins to really relax. The heart chakra, that begins to really, you begin to feel very alive there. You know, there's the beating heart to the left there. But if you spend some time, and all of us do, I think, in the center of the chest, around that whole area, there's a lot of life there. But if we remain in thought, we never notice that. And there are other ways to perceive life than just thought. There are ways to perceive life through the body, to intuit life through the heart, through the breath system. And this kind of sensitivity to our energetic component, to our body component, is where we have a chance to really make choices which truly liberate the heart. So whatever your moods are, you know, the choices are being made. Choices are being made. And that is the kind of frightening thing about the law of karma, is that if you don't make good choices, you accumulate unskillful results. But the beauty of the law of karma is, no matter what the accumulated consequences of my life are right now, I've always got this chance to make a choice. Even if the momentum of the difficult things that I might be facing is strong, even then I can always make a choice. So if I, like, even if you have a panic attack or you feel really, really down, okay, that's the resultant karma. But right now, I can make a choice to not think in that way. I can make a choice to feel that. And then those choices have the accumulated consequences of peace and liberation. The fruits of the practice, they come on their own. Just because you make the right choices, you don't have to worry about that. Sometimes we feel maybe, because I've never found this whole Buddhist thing easy. I'm amazed at how much stuff I've had to go through. And sometimes you can feel kind of despondent that, oh, here comes again that mood again. But if you look back, if you kind of just cast back and say, well, actually, that was a difficult thing I've worked through, or these mind states are difficult, and I am getting better. You know, the heart is lighter, the heart is more at ease, or whatever. Rather than just judging the immediate situation, because the ideal mind, the idealized model of what you should be, quite often just judges, oh, there I go, I'm angry again, or there I'm going to have fear. But if you look back, well, actually, there is more space, there is more empathy, you know, there is more tolerance, there is more patience. And so that's a kind of encouraging way to look at the difficulties you might face in practice, because you do have to encourage yourself. Very important. Because if the mind is in a judgmental mode and is constantly you're kind of saying you're not up to the mark, then the practice becomes hopeless. Your heart really closes down. So how can I make choices which are sort of encouraging and yet also responsible? You're kind of responsible for the negativity you might be experiencing. Then the openness of the heart, that just is quite natural. We encourage that openness through metta practice and so on. But the purification of the heart is really we find the consequences of the purification of the heart. The heart's very, very free, very open, very receptive. That's our right. That's our destination. That's the beauty of the Buddhist practice, is that our destination is freedom. It's a very optimistic kind of teaching. But its emphasis is on taking responsibility for a lot of that negativity and working it through. So I encourage you all in your practice, and if you're ever in Ottawa, I make a good cup of coffee. Do come and visit. Yeah. I'll leave that there.